The birth of a baby is a defining moment in a woman's life.
But what about the birth of a mother?
That's right, when a baby is born, so too is a mother.
This transition from woman to mother has a name. It's called matrescence.
This developmental stage is as powerful and irreversible as adolescence, and yet few women have ever heard of it.
So let's talk about it.
Let's talk about it. Each episode, we will bring you honest and thought-provoking conversations, evidence-based research and knowledgeable guests in order to help you emerge a more powerful and aligned version of yourself.
So join us, your hosts Kelly and Bree, as we attempt to make sense of our matrescence journey and to help you make sense of yours.
In this episode, I wrote my husband Anthony into telling our birth stories together. You'll have to bear with me as I jump around a little bit, sometimes miss important things and generally get in the way of letting him tell the story. I had no idea I'd be so nervous interviewing my own husband. But the result is beautiful. It's an honest and thoughtful account of our births through his eyes. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I did, listening to him tell our stories through his own eyes. So welcome and thank you for joining me today. A bit of an interesting one to sit down and tell our birth stories together. I'm here with my husband.
Do you need me to say something?
How excited you are to be here with me today.
Yes, I'm very excited.
Great. So if you've already listened to some of our earlier podcasts, you will realise that I have two boys aged 11 and 12 currently. So we are going to talk today about the story of each of their births briefly, and also about the loose context of our parenting over those last 12 years. So starting with the eldest, we had not planned to have children, so finding out that we were pregnant was a surprise, which meant that we had a really condensed period of time to work out how we wanted to birth, where we wanted to birth, how we wanted to parent, and to get really clear about the alignment of values and what was important to us as we went into this really important phase of our life. So before we go into the birth itself, I just want to ask you, what do you remember about that moment when I said, I'm pregnant, and what were the feelings? And you can be very honest, because I know this was not one of those, wow, yippee moments for you.
Well, I think you touched on it earlier. We weren't certainly weren't trying for a child, and we're about to move overseas, so there was the added complexity around that, but you know, for a long time I'd always wanted to be a father, but when it comes and it's not planned, it's still a shock, and I knew I was with the right person, so that wasn't a concern. But I knew things were going to change. In my mind, I had big plans for when we lived overseas, and they sort of had to be rethought through. I can't say I was disappointed. I was probably, thinking back, I was still pretty happy, but, you know, it's those mixed emotions that you go through. Is this good? Yes, it is. How's it going to affect us in the future, going into this period of big change for both of us? So it was a real mixed bag. And a lot of ups and downs, I think.
Yeah. No, that's good to hear your perspective, because I don't ever remember us thinking, oh, this can't happen. It was like, oh, it's happened. What are we going to do now? And what does it mean? So
yeah, and obviously there's options for people that, you know, we all know about, but it was never an option not to just continue on. So that was the big thing. And I think, because I knew I was with the right person and the time was probably never going to get better, we just took the ball and run with it.
Yeah, so fast forward, and we ended up going to the UK, getting enrolled in midwifery-led care under the National Health Service over there. And you attended many of those appointments. And I think we were really lucky, and I touched on this in another episode, we were very lucky to go into that system, because we really didn't know what we didn't know. But that bubbled up a bunch of information, which helped me write my birth preferences, which at that time we called a birth plan. And reading back over those and even watching our videos, I think both of us were reasonably informed for first-time parents about what was going to happen and the options. Now, that by no means prepares you for labour, but at least we knew what we wanted out of that birth process. And in particular, my fight to be able to have a natural birth, given that I had a prior medical history, and being allowed to go into the labouring wards. So it all starts with a friend of mine arriving on the Friday night. I worked right up until I went into labour, and a friend of mine who wanted to be at the birth, and at the time I'd never really heard of people having someone outside at the birth, which is ironic now that I'm, you know, planning to be a doula. But a friend of mine really wanted to be there. I asked Anthony and he said, yeah, that's fine. To be honest, neither of us were that comfortable with it, but we also weren't uncomfortable with it. It was just like, well, if you really want to, I suppose it's okay. So she kept having a dream that the baby had come, even though I thought I was going to go late. And she arrived on the Friday night and we proceeded to have a really good time. So cooked dinner, had a few drinks. And do you remember what happened on that night?
I think her and I got into a drinking contest, which seemed like a good idea at the time, and clearly it wasn't. But, you know, I think going back a step, all of those classes that we went to, I think that we were in a really good place. I think London, maybe because of its population and its access to universities and all of that sort of good stuff, they really had a lot of programs in place that helped us through it. But I say to any dad out there that you still feel like the third wheel, no matter how many of these things you go to. You know, your wife's obviously the pregnant one and you're going along to support her, but you do feel like the third wheel, and sometimes you don't feel like you have a voice, and that's not something that comes from your wife or partner, but I suppose it comes from within yourself. I know it did for me, and I sort of had to just go along with the process, I suppose. But maybe that was part of my insecurity. Maybe that was because it was my first time, because I think with the second time it does get easier, but the first time you're really like a deer in headlights to a lot of these things, and obviously you go to certain appointments by yourself without me, because there's no need for me to be there, but obviously it can be a bit of a weird time for the male, I suppose, because all the focus is on the female, and probably rightly so, but I'm just saying that for anyone out there that is feeling this way, it's probably normal, I think, from speaking to other fathers as well.
Yeah, it's a good point, and I suppose this is why this is such a powerful conversation. I never really thought about there's no preparation for fathers at all. You go along and the woman gets poked and prodded and asked, how are you, how are you going, what do you need? But you are a passenger on that. There's no, you know, what do you think you need to do to prepare as a father? There's only the question of what do you do when the baby comes out? Do you want skin to skin or not? But it's nothing about that mental, psychological, emotional preparation for becoming a father.
Yeah. I probably could have enjoyed the process more if it wasn't my first. I think it would have been, I would have had the, you know, the background, but there's always got to be a first time. And I suppose in hindsight to go through all that was a good thing.
That's so interesting. The women, we feel the same as women. Like if I only knew what I knew then, you know, so that's great reflection. Thanks.
So we, back to the story, but yeah, we decided to get into a drinking contest because I don't really know why, but it was like a release of a lot of build-up of stress coming up to the birth that you probably at the time don't realize, because everyone just thinks you should be happy, and there is a lot of stress. And I must admit, I was probably stressed for your health and the baby's health the whole pregnancy. Mm. Because, you know, I can sometimes be a half glass full kind of person. Sorry, half glass empty, I should say. And I worry about things like that. Is the baby going to be healthy? Is my wife going to be safe? And all of that. So I think it was an accumulation of all that stress, and the baby was so close. So probably not the best idea, and I don't recommend it, but that's what it ended up happening.
Well, it was one of the funnest memories that I have, because the friend that came was a very close friend of both of us, and we all got along very well. So it was a very funny, fun night. Unfortunately, what happened was at 6 a.m. the next morning, my waters broke.
Mm.
And there were a couple of sore heads, hungover heads in the house that morning whilst I'm saying,
on. Just to be clear, you weren't drinking.
No.
It was only her and I.
No, I was a sober observer of a very fun night. And off we went to bed, and 6 a.m. I woke up and my waters had broke. Now, there was a complication, because I had very heavy meconium-stained waters. And for anyone who doesn't know, that means that the baby had done a poo inside of me. So you get this green streaking. And what it means is that you're on the clock. So you know that you need to get that baby out within a certain amount of time, which set us on a path for my labour that I was hoping to avoid. So I knew at this point that as soon as I went to the hospital, that I would be not allowed to leave, that I would be very closely monitored. And I'd always wanted a natural birth and to be able to labour at home as long as I could. And so they basically said to me, you need to come in as soon as possible. So I then roused the troops, who were feeling a little worse for the wear, but it gave me a really good excuse to focus on something else, because at this point I wasn't in full-blown contractions or labour. However, I did have the niggling of the early contractions. So bacon and eggs for breakfast as I cooked, and we laughed and we drank coffee and we carried on, and the three of us all prepared to go off to the hospital, which we did sometime after 10 o'clock that morning. And we arrived at a very large, busy central London hospital, and was quite a different experience. So I was not allowed to go into the birth centre because of the meconium. So we went straight into a room and I began my journey of labouring. But because of the meconium, I was asked to be induced. So that meant I had the oxytocin drip put straight on. I was connected to a drip and a continuous monitor. And so things got pretty intense pretty fast. I'm curious on your memory of that, because to be honest, my memory, it's more than 12 years ago. It's pretty, patchy, I would say.
Well, I'll probably go back a step again and just say that I didn't think it was a great idea to have someone else in the room with us. And the reason I say that is because I almost had this view that it was a very private moment, even though there are obviously other people in the room, but it was a pretty private moment, and I wanted it to be just between Kel and I. And you know, it was one of those things that in hindsight it was just perfect to have Sherry there, because it allowed me a bit of a distraction. You know, your wife or partner's in a lot of pain, and going back to what I said earlier, you do feel like the third wheel. You do feel like, what do I do? You know, no one's telling you what to do. Every time someone comes into the room, they're asking about your wife, not about you. And that's fair enough. It's not about me, but there's all this emotion going on as a dad, and seeing your wife in so much pain and not really knowing what to ask for or you know, what to do. So to have Sherry there was really good, because it added a distraction, but also like simple things like if we wanted something from the local shop, she popped out and got it while I stayed with Kel. So I didn't feel like I was just leaving Kel to her own devices. And the opposite, I could go outside for a breath of fresh air without feeling like Kel was alone. So you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it was really awesome in that first birth to have someone there as a support person. And so I didn't feel like I was just, you know, that invisible person in the room.
Mm, absolutely. Because, you know, you walk into that room and you don't leave until the baby's born. And for us, that was more than 12 hours. Now, for me, whilst I was very much in the thick of labour, time doesn't mean much. I mean, it feels like it's a long time, but I had no real sense of time or space. Whereas for the both of you, watching and staying there with me, it would have felt like a really long time to be inside that little hospital room.
Well, it was exhausting, and there was a concern. You know, the nurses and the occasional doctor that came in, there was a real concern around Angus's health. But it's like a football match. You don't know what the final result's going to be, so you can't relax the whole time. It's a high stress situation, even though maybe you don't feel stressed all the time, but I can tell you now it is a high stress, and we'll probably come to it later, but at the end I felt like I'd gone 10 rounds with Mike Tyson. It was tough, even though you did all the physical and the emotional. The emotional really weighed on me at the end of the day.
Yeah. So the labour goes on, and different women need different things during labour. One of the things for me was I felt this enormous gratitude to Sherry, and I do want to shout out. It was amazing that you shared that journey with us, because you did provide the support to Anthony during that time, and actually you supported each other as well as me, because there were long stretches of time where I was one of those labouring mothers who was like, don't touch me, just leave me alone, stay away from me most of the time. And occasionally I needed something. It was, you know, can you brush my hair or can you rub my back? But for the majority of time, I actually was so much in my own zone. I just didn't want anyone around me to touch me. So you both providing a safe space for me, monitoring to make sure I had enough fluid, being on call when you needed me, but there was long stretches which could have otherwise been you having a conversation with yourself and increasing stress levels as opposed to a bit of distraction. And I do remember you making me laugh a lot, which I then used in my second birth, because I remember how good it felt of they have one of those big lights on a boom arm to look in, you know, at the vagina when the baby's coming out. And I can distinctly remember sort of being on a birth ball, leaning over the bed, rolling in contraction labour, and looking up and seeing the two of you using it as a microphone and doing some Elvis moves and singing and making me laugh, which gave me a flood of oxytocin and helped the labour come along, which was great. So, you know, amusing yourselves and me was part of that process. And I think the staff really left the three of us alone as much as they could, apart from checking on us. Is my memory fairly straight?
Yeah,
there?
No, that was probably it. And I think there were times as well where I'm not very good at, like sometimes when you were being sick and so on. So it was really good for Sherry to be there, because she could support you a bit better than me. And I know that sounds silly, but if I smell vomit, I want to vomit, and you don't want two people vomiting in a birth suite. So I just was able to step away, take a deep breath of fresh air, and Sherry could just pat you on the back and tell you it was going to be all right. And like, those little things are the things probably I remember the most, because and it happened in the second birth as well, but a bit differently. But you realise that, you know, Kel's body just wants to expel everything before the baby comes. And, you know, it's like a poltergeist movie. And you're just going, what the hell am I doing? Like, it was pretty shocking.
Yeah, that's one of the things no one ever tells you about birth, is that you vomit and there's poo and vomit. And it's because your body is getting rid of everything. Getting ready for that baby.
I think for you as well, you were sort of strapped to this contraption. I think it was the medication they were giving you, but you kept thinking you needed to go to the toilet, so you'd waddle out with the pole thing, and you'd go to the bathroom, and nothing had happened anyway. But it's just because there's so much pressure from the baby down there that you just kept thinking, oh, I need to go to the toilet. So there was constantly this back and forward with that.
And what I know now is, of course, that's very natural, and actually many women labour on the toilet. But at the time I was in a very large public hospital, and the toilet was down the hall.
Yeah.
So I'm strapped to...
Wasn't in your room.
No, so I had an IV drip in, I had continuous monitoring, and I'm trying to move around. But we got through a fairly long labour, and because I also did not want to have a medicated birth as much as possible, I was induced, but I was holding out and I really wanted to have a natural birth. Again, I know a lot more now. It's very, very difficult to do that because of the synthetic hormones, the way they bring on the contractions. And quite after a good 9 or 10 hours of labouring, I got quite stressed. And we hit a point where I just wasn't dilating anymore. And the nurses, the midwives came to me at that point, and they really gave me a pretty hard conversation about if something doesn't shift, we need to get your baby out. You really are on a time limit now, and you need to consider your options, which at that point is when I decided that I would take some form of medication, and they gave me pethidine. Now, one of the reasons I didn't want any form of drugs is because I don't react particularly well with drugs. And what ensued was another funny incident where I was completely off the planet from the pethidine, really delirious, hallucinating, telling funny stories, funny for everyone else but me. But it did kickstart my labour again, because I was able to relax and things moved pretty fast after that.
Yeah, I think rightly or wrongly, I felt like we were put under a bit of pressure from the hospital staff. And I felt like we lost a bit of power at that time. But, you know, I think you get to a point where you've got to trust the people around you and what they're saying. But I did feel like, and it was high stress anyway, so, but I felt like that was probably the most negative part. I felt like we were put under pressure to do something initially we didn't want to do. But when someone says to you, think about the health of your baby and stuff like this, you know, it puts a lot of doubt into your mind. So you sort of have to hand over to them to do what's right. But I think in hindsight, and this is no criticism of anyone who works in the hospital, but they sometimes say things in a way that maybe isn't very, it doesn't come across as very sympathetic. It was quite pressured. I felt quite pressured by it. And I almost felt like they forced us into something that we didn't want to do.
Yeah. And look, in the end, be it what it may, we things moved, and once I recovered my senses, which took a little while because the drugs did knock me around a lot, then it got into the really, I guess, intense part in the transition to labour, and I was then able to get onto all fours and begin birthing the baby. Now, when the head came out, he was quite blue, quite unresponsive. And so, again, we hit another situation where they put a lot of pressure on us. Now, again, I know a lot more now than I did 12 years ago, but at the time, I couldn't really see. We didn't really know what was going on, but I remember the midwife coming up and saying to me, you need to get this baby out. Give it all you've got in the next contraction and push the baby out. And so I do remember bearing down and giving an almighty push, to which he came flying out, tearing lots of bits and pieces on the way out. But he came out and he was quite unresponsive. However, I very quickly turned around and wanted him brought to my chest. And you also, you said, wait, don't cut the cord, because we really wanted him to have an extended period of time to get the cord blood, to which they actually declined that and said, no, we really need to take him and resuscitate. Now, again, there's very new research about the resuscitation, and they do suggest you keeping the cord attached. However, at the time the decision was made and the cord was cut and he was taken away to resuscitate, and there was a a brief and terrifying period of time, which I actually don't know how long it was, you may remember more, before we could hear the noises of a newborn.
Yeah, and I suppose for all the dads out there, when the baby just sort of started to come out, the midwife asked me, do you want to come and have a look? Like I was meant to be excited. And I remember thinking, no, not really. I don't want to have a look. And I sort of did have a look, and that was very, I don't know, people think the dad's ought to just be like, this is the happiest moment of my life. And it's just like so weird and surreal, even though it's, you know, so beautiful and you know, the new life coming out. But it was just like, no, I don't cope well with this. And that's why sometimes, you know, some dads would probably cope better than I would, and some would probably cope worse than I would. You know, you hear the old saying that dads used to faint in the birthing room. I wasn't that bad, but I certainly wasn't as excited as maybe people thought I should be. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of interesting. But yeah, so when the baby came out and you just see him blue, he was like a smurf, and they cut him and just took him away. But they didn't sort of say anything to us for a little while. So that mm-hmm. was a very high stress moment. Like, I think if I had a stress meter on, it would have been at whatever mm-hmm. the maximum is. It was really high stress. So yeah, it did accumulate to a pretty high peak of emotion.
Mm. And then they wrap them up and bring them back. And
yeah, they called me over, weirdly, to show me how to put a nappy on this new baby. And
I could, that's really relevant at that
yeah,
minute.
Yeah, it was kind of really, thinking back, it was sort of out of place. But and they weighed him, so on these large old butcher scales, because it was quite an old hospital that's no longer there as a hospital. But but yeah, that was kind of interesting. And then we had this new baby, and it's just one of those moments where I don't know. I can't say I was stoked. I can't say I was totally happy. I was just like relieved that he was breathing, and that you were okay as well.
Mm. There's so then he comes onto my chest for a bit of breastfeeding, and there's one more funny anecdote, which is when they go to clean up downstairs. I don't remember the placenta being born.
No,
I don't remember.
I don't remember. I think I was with him when they were doing whatever they did. So I actually don't know. But I do remember, and I'm probably jumping ahead because I know you've got some stories in between, but I do remember this lady, like a seamstress, in between your legs, sewing you up while I was talking to my dad in Australia. And I'm looking across, watching my wife getting sewn up. That was one of those moments that was sort of so bizarre. You couldn't read about it, sort of thing. So it was pretty funny. And I can't remember if I even told my dad at the time, but I still have a vivid memory of that in my head.
Mm.
And one thing about the UK as well, and I don't know if they still do it, but they bring in toast and tea after you've had a baby, which I think is really nice, but bizarre at the same time.
I think they do that here.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
I don't think they did with Jack.
No.
But I think you had something to eat and then you spewed it up again. So it was like, but I thought it was kind of one of those kooky things that seems out of place, but it was actually quite a nice touch.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, with amazing feelings of the birth and the first breastfeed, and then we get wrapped up.
We'll go back to the breastfeed, because your boob was about four times the size of his head. And we do have a photo. and you just can't believe how this little mouth is gonna, you know, get anything out of that, because it's just massive and swollen. And and as we find out later, he did have a lot of problems with that, but it was you know, one of those things that you think it's all going to be easy and it doesn't all go to plan.
No, that's right. And they, you know, they say put the nipple to the back of the mouth, and you think, well, the nipple's the size of a dinner plate now, and his head's the size of my fist, so there's something misaligned here. But
So, and everyone's different, because Jack was a different story altogether, but maybe that comes with experience. But I think if you get 100 people in a room and ask them about their birth story, it's 100 different stories. So you can read all the generic stuff you want, which is a great base, but it's not going to be how yours turns out. So just always remember that yours is going to be a totally unique experience. And I can't take, because I'm generally a stressed person anyway, I can't take the stress out of these things, but I wish I could enjoy them more, and hopefully you can too.
So before we go on to the second birth, because I think it's a good comparison, just when you left the hospital that night. So by the time I got back to my room, he was born about 10 o'clock at night. We got back, it was after midnight. I sent you and Sherry home to get some rest. And then what happened?
Well, I'll tell you a couple of stories and coming back to the hospital as well. But because we lived in London, we didn't have a car, and we weren't that far from the hospital. We were actually, I don't know, 20 minutes on a bus. So we just decided to catch a bus home. And was it a Saturday night?
It was a Saturday night.
So there were people on the bus, you know, just, I don't know what they were on, whether it be alcohol or other, Panadol or something. I don't know. But there were people on the bus just looking dreadful. So you've just gone through this whole experience and, you know, newborn baby, so perfect, blah, 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 blah. And you get on a bus that's like a horror show. And I was exhausted, and I was sort of a bit at the end of my tether. And yeah, we caught the bus home. So that was a bit surreal. And then I just collapsed on the bed. I was just, I just think we walked in the door and Sherry was sleeping downstairs. I was upstairs. I just basically walked in the door, said, see you in the morning, walked straight upstairs and just crashed on the bed. And I don't think I got up till, I just slept. I didn't get up till about 9 o'clock the next day, I think it was. You're probably wondering where the hell I was, but I was just so exhausted. Which is kind of weird, because the, you know, you went through it all, but yeah, I was spent.
It's not an uncommon thing to have that real physical, emotional, and just exhaustion after the process, but not something that gets talked about very much.
Well, I came back the next day. I caught the bus, and I had the capsule that could go in a car. So we teased Kel's dad for a long time that I was just going to catch a bus home with you, and he was getting so worked up about it.
Yeah, kept offering us the money for the black cab. So it's fine, the bus trip's fine, don't worry about it.
Bus trip's fine. But yeah, I think people thought I was a bit weird because I was on the bus with a capsule with no baby in it. But I caught the bus, and with the plan to catch a cab home. And so I went there, and, you know, it was great to see Kel. And I remember taking a photo that day. It was just such a stunning day. It was a blue sky. It was beautiful. And I remember taking a photo as I was walking to the hospital, just took a photo of the sky and the buildings, and, you know, just as one of those memories to say, oh, man, what a perfect day this is. And you stuck Angus in my arms, and I was holding him. And I think people expect you to love your baby straight away, and they expect you to just outpour, you know, this gushingness of love. And I was just like, what the hell is this? What? In some ways, I was having these conversations. I can't believe I'm a dad. And and all of that sort of stuff. And it was, I remember thinking this should probably be the happiest day of my life, but it wasn't. It was just such a hodgepodge of emotions that there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of confusion. And it took me a long time to sort of, you know, and we'll probably talk about this some other time, but it took me a long time to feel like I was a dad and feel like I was, you know, even a good dad. So I feel like I was just surviving for the first few weeks and months, I suppose. And I don't know if we'll touch on it in this conversation, but, you know, Angus had a lot of health problems, so it was tough.
Mm. Yeah, and I think both of us felt like we were surviving, but also partly in our own little bubble of survival with this creature between us that needed us.
Mm.
Really, really emotional and tough time that we've managed to get through.
Yeah, but, you know, I wouldn't change it. No. At the same time, it's not like, you know, it's not like anything really bad happened, but it seemed bad at the time. It seemed like it put a lot of pressure on us.
Mm. So the second birth, we went back pretty quickly for and the second birth, and I think that was partly me just saying, well, if we don't do it now, we may never do it.
Yeah, we weren't spring chickens, I suppose. So.
No. So no point waiting. And pretty straightforward pregnancy again. We had a toddler and pregnant. We had by this stage moved home to Australia, so it was a really different context, very different pregnancy and birth, but in a country hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And very different labour, because my waters broke first thing in the morning, about 8 o'clock in the morning. We organised for my mum to come and pick up Angus so that we could spend the day together. And this time I was really determined that I wanted to stay at home as long as possible and had no signs of meconium. And so this is one of my favourite things. Do you remember what we did that day?
Yeah, we just watched back-to-back Billy Connolly DVDs. DVDs in those days, kids. I don't know if you've heard of them, but I don't think it was VHS.
No, it was DVDs. It was DVDs.
But we just, yeah, we watched anything that was funny, and we had a really nice house, like we were on an acre block, and it was just nice, and it was very different. It was very different to the first birth, you know.
I think two things. One is both of us knew a little bit more what to expect and therefore how to manage it. But because there wasn't that pressure of immediacy of time, we felt we had time and space to be together. We closed the curtains. It was nice and dark. We watched the comedian and we laughed and laughed and laughed. And I sat on a birth ball for the whole time again, which I did with my first labour. But this time, no monitoring, no IV, plenty of ability to move around. And the labour intensified throughout the day, went through the whole day, and at some point I think we got to the point where I said, I think we better go to the hospital, which was about a 20-minute drive away.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever had a contraction in a car, it's not pleasant, so you've got to find that window. So you drove me to the hospital, and I remember walking up the stairs. I don't know why a maternity hospital has stairs. Maybe that's part of the process of bringing the baby down. Stairs to get to mm-hmm. the floor.
There were stairs in the UK too.
Yeah.
It was an old hospital, admittedly. Yeah. Oh, I suppose they both are.
Both are old hospitals. Yeah.
But, yeah, it was just very different. And it was empty. The hospital was empty, which probably comes as no surprise.
Yeah, I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure the night that Angus was born in London, there were 37 babies born on the ward that night in that one ward. Whereas that night we were the only labouring family that arrived at this country hospital, and it was a totally different experience. So I remember walking up to the nurse's station and saying, you know, hi, I'm in labour, and them doing the usual thing like, well, why do you think you need to be here? And how long apart are your contractions? And started to ask me questions. And I had a contraction right at that second.
Mm.
And I can remember, like, I just grabbed the edge of the nursing station and I was hanging it off it and just roaring out this contraction.
Mm.
And she went, right then, I think we'll get you up on the bed. And we walked in and I sat on the bed and you took a photo of me.
No, well, before that, I've got to go to the toilet and puke, remember?
I ran through the birthing suite and straight away I was to the toilet vomiting. And it turns out I was actually in transition at this point, which I didn't realise. And the nurse sort of, or midwife said to you at the time, go over there and support your wife. And he went, no, she doesn't want me. And I was going, no. Leave me alone. Don't touch me. As I'm emptying everything into the toilet.
Well, it's another thing where you do feel like the spare wheel, but you also know your own limits. And I knew if Kel was going to spew, I just couldn't handle it. She knew that too. So she was happy to do it by herself. But you've got these people around you that you don't know. You've only met 5 seconds ago.
Mm.
So basically telling you what to do, and it can be unsettling.
Yes, because although I had midwifery led care with both of my children, they were in systems where I actually didn't know any of the midwives. So on both situations, when I turned up on the day to give birth, I'd never met anyone in the room, which again, I don't recommend. There's lots of reasons why it's great to build a strong, deep relationship with your birthing team. I didn't have that. But I seem to remember you overhearing you say, if I go over there, I'm probably going to vomit on the back of her head and then it'll be a bigger mess. Yeah. And she kind of had a half giggle and I'm going, no, it's fine. I'm okay.
And yeah, to take a step back on what I said, the women there that night were just fantastic and awesome and funny. But she was obviously thinking she was doing the right thing by you, by sending me in, but we both knew better. And we probably were a bit more comfortable this time around.
Yeah. So I do the usual and I emptied out, climbed up on the bed. You took a photo and the time said something like 6:05 p.m. I climbed up on the bed and I was in the lull between transition and birth at that point. It was all reasonably calm and then things kicked up a gear and I was on my hands and knees roaring that baby out again.
Yep, no drugs?
No, didn't even have time. To be honest, I don't even think the midwives had any idea how close I was until I got up on that bed and they were like, oh, the baby's coming. So, and there is another funny anecdote about the pushing the baby out, which I'd love you to tell.
Yeah, I've got a sense of this a bit, but...
it's okay. I can put an explicit on the recording.
Okay. So Kel was on all fours and so I'm sort of up with Kel, up at her shoulder level, and she is pushing and taking the instructions from the midwife, who's saying push and okay, let's relax. And then the next one, the midwife says, okay, we're going to really push this next one. And you did that, and all this water. So her and the other lady are down the end of the bed. All this water just sprayed out of you onto her. And it was like a comedy movie. And there were bits of water just... She had quite a large cleavage and the water was sort of running down into her cleavage. And she just looked and went, oh, fuck. And that just cracked me up. After listening to Billy Connolly all day, I thought, that is gold. And she was very good about it. And look, no one would want a total stranger's bodily fluids over them, let's face it. But she was just awesome. And, you know, there was no dramas with that, but it was a very funny moment that certainly broke the ice for me.
Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, our baby came out, and just very calm, very much just up on the chest.
It was a total different level of stress. It was, I don't know if it's because of the hospital of where we are at Armidale in New South Wales, but it was just so relaxed in the hospital. There was no other people, as Kel said. The midwives did what they needed to do and then left us alone. and it was just peaceful and quiet. Mm. And he was, he came out so naturally, and you know, there were no complications. So it was like, I wasn't at the height of the stress I was with the first one. And, you know, various things come with that, like, because I'd been through it with Angus, but it was certainly, I just remember it being a really nice experience, and probably a, what you'd almost call a perfect birth.
Mm. Yeah, it was a lovely experience, and I think my body was in a much better place afterwards because I hadn't had the interventions. I hadn't had as much. I don't even think I had any tearing. I honestly can't even remember.
Well, I don't think you did.
But I don't think I did.
No.
And just a very natural process of actually just, you know, injecting the baby according to the natural instincts. So, and we had a lot of time to be left alone afterwards, just to be with our baby and get the first feed and spend time. So,
and it was earlier in the night too. So it was like we weren't exhausted. I could stay longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I left pretty much. So.
Mm. And look, with my first birth, you know, they discharged me. Like we birthed it up sometime after 10 p.m. I was discharged by 9 or 10 o'clock the next morning with the first baby that unfortunately was actually quite unwell. And if I had have known what I know now, I wouldn't have let them discharge me with a sick baby. But I didn't know that at the time. Whereas with him, they were saying to me, well, you'll stay 2 or 3 days. And I was like, no, I'm going home. And they're like, no, you can't go home. I said, just watch me. You know, like, I've been here before. I want to go home to my own home. I'm
yeah,
fine.
It was funny and certainly no criticism of people, but you realise hospitals are under stress, especially a big one in London. They need beds.
Mm.
So it's not that they're not caring. It's they've got, there's pressures there to free up beds. So if your baby appears normal, you know, then you're out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for us, I don't think any of the rooms were full in Armidale. So it was like, oh, no, stay for a few days. That's all right. And we're like, no, we're going home. We want to be home.
Yeah.
And there's in our minds, there's no reason for us to stay.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But yeah. It was a really lovely experience and totally different.
So I think we've covered a fair bit today. I'd like to talk at another time about our parenting journey with I guess a bit of change of roles in the future, if you're open to doing that with me, about the times when you were the primary caregiver of the children and I was working. But to wrap up today, I'd really just love to hear any, I guess, final thoughts you have about you know, the feelings of being a dad or the birth process, which is really what, you know, this transition that we go through doesn't just happen to women. It happens to men too. We just don't talk about it a lot. And that's one of the things I wanted to bring up today, I guess.
Well, I think for men, you do, and I said it a bit earlier, you do feel like, you know, you're the third wheel and maybe you're not as involved as obviously the mother, so you can feel a bit I don't know what the term is, but you do feel a bit left out. And I know when after Angus was born, because he was such a demanding baby, there was a level of resentment there as well, because all of a sudden your wife or your partner is almost 100% committed to this baby. And selfishly, you don't get any time. So I don't think it's, looking back, I don't think that's abnormal. I don't think that's something that that people don't go through. But it is a mix of emotions, because you can feel like, well, why don't I love this baby? But you sort of are fighting those things as well, a bit of resentment, you know.
Yeah.
And I know people probably won't like that, because they like things to be perfect, and how could you not love your baby and all of that. And it's not that you don't love your baby, but there is a level of resentment at times, because everything that you're used to and is taken away. And yeah, it is hard to say in hindsight, because I wouldn't change anything, but I suppose I wasn't as prepared as I thought I was for the first baby. I think I was better equipped the second baby. Mm. And what added to that as well with the second baby, he was an easier baby. He was a lot happier. He was funny, whereas Angus had a lot of health problems, and we had to get through that.
Mm.
In hindsight, you know, it's easy for me to say I should have been more sympathetic, but I'm just being truthful. There was a lot of times where I was doubting myself as a father, and having some resentment.
Mm. And our society doesn't have a lot of good role modelling or conversations about that anyway. It's not like anyone you ever knew had that honest conversation about the mixed feelings. It's all slapping on the back and let's have a beer and congratulations, especially in our society.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, without going too far into it, but, you know, I didn't have a great relationship with my father, so it probably did muddy the waters a bit for me as well. And I didn't have that person to speak to. I only in the past, well, my father's passed away now, but only in the sort of 4 years before he died, did we sort of retrieve some of our relationship. So I didn't have that good role model that I could even just talk to about it. But yeah, our relationship changed. My father and my relationship changed for the better after my boys were born.
Mm-hmm. It was a great healing moment for the two of you to perhaps bring those boys into his life.
Yeah, but I still, even though I had a great last few years with him, I didn't feel like I wasn't going to go to him for fatherly advice, because I know what I'd been through. So you know what I mean? So I couldn't have those conversations with him.
And that is another conversation, you know, how to learn to be a father when you haven't been fathered particularly well yourself. Yeah. It's pretty complicated.
Yeah, but it was a journey, and I wouldn't change anything. But don't think it's going to be, you know, as they write about in the books. It's all an individual journey.
And, you know, for me, it's really amazing that even despite all these feelings, you went on in the years that followed to look after the boys through their toddler years, into school.
It's because I wanted a job where I could stay in my pyjamas all day.
Well, you were still forced to go out of the house and take them to the park.
It's true.
But, that's a big call.
It was a big call. And look, I loved, you know, I grew into that, and I love spending time with them. And I think any father that gets a chance to take some time off or reduce their work hours, say to 4 days a week or something, and spend that time with their kids before they go to school, then do it. If you can afford it financially, or if you just go, stuff it, I'm going to do it anyway, do it, because they grow up too fast. And you know what? When you're in it, you don't believe it. And it's only when Angus is going to high school this year that I think, wow, I could have missed all of those years.
Yeah, and all those years when you boys would be off for adventures, driving up, going in the bush, hiking, going to the park, going to the beach and playing and just enjoying play together. And you fathering them through those years was just, you can't get it back.
No, you can't get it back. And I suppose even with my background with my father, I was determined to do it differently.
Well, thank you for sharing this conversation with me. I really appreciate it, and I know that our listeners will really appreciate your honesty. And I hope we can have another conversation soon.
If there's free beer, I'm here.
I can organise that. Thanks for joining us for today's conversation. If you want to hear more like this, don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. If you'd like to know more about anything we talked about or you heard on the podcast today, check out our website, www.birthofamother.com.au. You can find us on Instagram at matrescence.podcast, or send us an email to info@birthofamother.com.au.
If you think others could benefit from this podcast, take a screenshot of you listening to this episode to post on your social media and tag us. Alternatively, consider leaving a review with your favourite things about the Matrescence podcast. This really helps us to increase our visibility and ensure we are reaching as many women as possible. As always, thank you for spending your time with us. We hope you will tune in next time.